Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Critic podcast. This week, I'm joined by Gal Traeger, a New York-based technology investor and a contributor to The Critic magazine. Gal, hello.
Hey. Great to be here. Pleasure being here.
Thank you for joining us. So we're here to discuss the topic of Gal's recent article for us entitled World Government or People's Governments. I'll let Gal outline the argument for you, but basically it involved the idea of two different paths in world affairs. Gal, would you like to take it away from there?
Yeah, sure. And thank you again for having me and glad to be here. So there are two basic intuitions behind the idea. One is that the world today is organized around nation states. And the second is that most people feel like the nation state institutions are not working. Mm. Right. So we're in this time of crisis. So those are like the two basic intuitions. And I think the moment we're in is one in there are a few different directions in which we can go. It doesn't feel that we're in a stable equilibrium, if you will. Mm. It doesn't feel like the current way we do politics or think about politics is something that will stay the same way for the long term. And then one should ask, okay, so where can this go? What is the direction we're taking? And what I'm kind of trying to outline in the article is that the direction that we might need to choose between, or the fork we are in the road, is between a world government and people's government. Mm. World government is a world in which the nation states actually become more intertwined between themselves and also in our lives and have more kind of social control and more global control. And people's government is a world in which actually the nation state is kind of fragmented into other sovereign entities based on different racial, ethnic, religious, cultural, economical characteristics. So those are like the two main futures I can envision us going from here.
You see, I mean, I was interested in this idea of sort of this more kind of regionalist breakdown that you saw, because I mean, I think most of the narratives we've heard, you know, somewheres and anywheres, you know, national conservatism, it's been a discussion about, you know, the nation versus the global. And there hasn't been so much focus on like more local levels of belonging or kind of sub or transnational ideas of belonging, you know, sort of religious and sort of regional identities. Do you like to say a little bit more about what caused you to focus on that rather than the nation state?
Yeah, so I think there is a nuance here. I think there's definitely a theme or a trend in thinking among like conservatives, kind of no conservatives, also on the left, by the way, around like kind of what you can term as positive populism, like listen to the people and listen to them seriously, right? And give them more autonomy, give them more power versus the institution. So I think that's definitely a thread. And what I'm saying relates to it, but I don't think it necessarily is going to be regional.
Okay.
So it's really hard for us to think about politics outside the realm of the national. For most people, for the last 200, 250 years, the political meant the national. And I think what we're seeing in the last 20, 30 years, and I think what we saw throughout of human history, is that people's identities can be, they're stronger, they're thicker, and identities can be subnational or unnational, however you want to put it. And those identities can have a powerful force to constitute a sovereign entity, right? So those are related arguments, because there's definitely an element in which people in some region today, and I think we might see it accelerating, will unite more, coalesce more to say, we don't want to be part of this federation. We don't want to be part of this nation state. we want to constitute our own sovereignty. The kind of argument around people's government is that this can happen based on region, but it can also happen based on religion, based on hobbies, based on occupation, based on race, based on tribe, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the way it was throughout human history until the emergence of the modern nation state.
Yeah, so I mean, we're talking really about kind of an overlapping series of identities. So, you know, you have people who might be divided by religion, but united by ethnicity or culture or language, and vice versa. So that people might feel more solidarity with people of a totally different race, language, culture, but they have this deep sense of reality in common. But then the opposite might be true. You might have people have solidarities across ideological boundaries. I mean, you know, so that's a familiar idea, but how does that idea of these overlapping identities translate into politics? So, I mean, I think for people familiar with modern political theory, you know, Weberian ideas of sovereignty, it seems like, well, politics is defined by having a single form of belonging. So how can, you know, these multiple and overlapping forms of belonging live alongside, you know, successful state formation and political life?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's the assumption that is very interesting and relevant to essentially unpack. So throughout human history, people lived together in political entities. That what held them together in those political entities were very different things. In the modern era, it's primarily nationalism. But it wasn't like that throughout tens of thousands of years, right? It was the family, it was the tribe, it was the region, it was the race, it was all those different things, right? And so the world we're in is an anomaly. The anomaly is that every, you look at the globe, you put your finger on every piece of land, and there is a nation state there, right? Now, whether this anomaly will be around forever, whether the world will be structured like that forever, I think it's fair to make the assumption that it might not be. And I think it's fair to make the argument that a lot of the problems we're seeing around the nation state, from immigration and racial tensions and economic inequality and dysfunctional politics, have to do that we took this political sovereign structure and kind of implemented many times top down on people with an evolving identity, right? So going back to your question, you can have a political entity that is not predicated on a national identity.
What would such a political entity look like? I mean, can you give examples?
Yeah, so I mean, you have like the Silicon Valley version is you raise money, you buy a piece of land, and you bring a bunch of people with similar aspirations or values or hobbies or occupation, and you settle there, right? It was also true historically, by the way, guilds in Middle Age Europe, they built autonomous political entities, right? So that's kind of, you have like this corporate sovereign individual version, techie version of that is happening in various parts around the world, Middle East, Latin America. So you have a few case studies of that happening. You have a lot of countries that were essentially formed around, you know, the former British Empire, like Malta, right? That are essentially like some historical anomalies. They were not constituted together around a core national identity, right? Europe historically, needless to say, 500 years ago, it was roughly 700 different political autonomous entities that had sovereignty on some piece of land around different different things. Sometimes it was around like market forces, like, you know, the kind of the merchant city state of Italy. Sometimes it was around a guild. Sometimes it was obviously around like some church or religion. Sometimes it was around a king, et cetera, right? So I can imagine it playing out in a lot of various ways. You will have the more outside in, and you have the inside out. The outside in is a bunch of people coming together, finding a piece of land, settling there around this common identity that they have. The other is inside out, which is, you know, people living on some piece of land saying, we don't want to be part of this national entity. It can be the succession of California or Texas. It can be South Tyrol in Italy, and it can be, the Scots in the UK, etc.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm interested in this, this idea of, we can just, people settle this piece of land, they'll seastead, they'll, they'll create an association or guild. But where does that, I'm interested in the process from that to the idea of a political representation of some kind. So, you can do the former easily enough in a modern nation state. You've got free association in the liberal West. You can do it. But then the moment one of the members of that community wants to live a different way, they can appeal, they can appeal over the heads of the rest of the community to national laws, to human rights, to all sorts of things that start to very quickly, limit your capacity to have a separate political structure. So I'm interested, do you think that creates tensions? Do you think that does that mean that the more kind of, irenic sort of associations, if they kind of harden up, start heading towards separatism? And what does that look like politically?
Yes, I mean, the short answer is it's a mess. I'm not saying it's kind of a very clean, seamless process, right? It's a political battle over power, authority, sovereignty, right? So if this version of the future plays out, it's a messy process. I'm not saying it's an easy, kind of smooth process that the kind of nation state will put down their swords kind of thing. But I think we're actually seeing it playing out. It's true for the suburbs of Paris and the suburbs of Silicon Valley. The suburbs of Paris is like the immigrants from North Africa, and the suburbs of San Francisco is the tech billionaire. So they're essentially running some form of limited sovereignty in their communities, right? And it's actually true for a bigger chunk of the world than we essentially articulate, if you will. Big parts of Africa, the Middle East, of Latin America, of Europe, of inner cities in the US. Yes, the nation state is a sovereign there in terms of what you see on the map and what you talk about in the UN, but practically speaking, they have a totally different set of rules that govern the. It's true for south of Italy, it's true for parts of Eastern Europe, right? So what I'm describing, perhaps, about the future is also a part of the present, right?
So, I mean, I'm interested in this part of your argument, which is that you present sort of people's government in the article in quite a utopian sense. This is going to be people having more of a say, being able to associate the way that they want, forms of suppressed belonging re-arising. But isn't there quite a kind of dystopian element with, for example, you mentioned like a lot of outside the West, sovereignty is weaker, but like somewhere like South Africa, sovereignty is very weak. The police force do very little, and the result is an incredibly high murder rate and one of the highest proportions of private security guards to individuals in the world. So the irony is that you lose the police, you end up with more of a police state than you began. And
Yeah,
that might
so
have been a lesson of pre-modernity. It'll be, the land of medieval Europe was full of castles and, low-level violence.
there is a version in which this is not utopian, and I don't think it will necessarily be utopian. I also talk a bit about the fact that the more sovereign entities we have, the clearer it is that a lot of them won't be free. But perhaps if we move from a world in which you have 200 countries or sovereign political entities to a world in which you have 2,000 or 5 or 10,000, the question of democracy and freedom is a bit different, right? Because there is something about freedom that has to do with the scale of the human population you're trying to manage. There's not a lot of freedom within a family many times, but there is kind of anarchy in this in the context of how nations behave with one another. So that's kind of a different line of argument. But to your question, I don't think this is a utopian thing. I think, but I do think it's a thing we need to try to better understand and think about, and obviously make sure that it's done in a way that is better for humankind and not worse. I'm not sure it's a reversible process. I think a lot of what we see, kind of the big political questions of our time, from taxation to immigration, to online censorship, to kind of government bureaucracy and how we should reform it, etc. Using this framework, you can understand it as all those problems arising from people's identities wanting to constitute new sovereignties for themselves.
Yeah, so I mean that's a sort of apt description of these kind of centrifugal forces pulling nation states apart. But one thing I'm interested in is you also identify these centripetal forces of sort of
Yep.
ever greater consolidation of law, economics, policy, culture, what we call often put under the heading of globalization. Would you like to say a little bit about that, the idea of a world government?
Yeah. So the and that's why I think it's a fourth, because one, I don't know which way it will play out, but I do think we're nearing decisions. And again, using this framework, you can understand a lot of what is actually going on today. So the kind of argument around world government is that governments today are very powerful, right? Not necessarily capable, but powerful in terms of the information they have, the physical power, if you will, the militaries, their ability to tax, etc. And given the kind of new technologies from the last 20, 30 years, their ability to be more pervasive increased. That's one. And second, there is a sense in which the main threats for humanity are kind of global, not local, whether it's climate change, nuclear proliferation, biological warfare, or epidemics and stuff like that. And that's both is creating a reason, but also an excuse to call us power that is more multinational, right? So there is definitely a future of China, if you will, on a broader scale, or kind of the more gentle version is some European Union that begets more and more countries, right? And the kind of censorship wars that in the news in the last few weeks and have been for a while around like how tech works with politics to essentially coalesce a broader base of body politic is definitely a future that is probably as well under discussed and investigated in terms of the threats it imposes.
Yeah, so is it that you see these two? Do you think this idea of edge greater kind of central hegemonic control? I mean, do you think that's something that could continue accelerating? I mean, do you think this fragment, because you mentioned a process of fragmentation, you speak to it as it has a certain momentum behind it. But equally, I mean, you look at something like, the way that China's dealt with the Uyghurs, that's a regional identity that isn't coming back anytime soon if they keep where they are. I mean, is it not a case for saying that, nation states and supranational organizations may simply just be too strong? They may just be able to keep the lid on, regional identities forever.
For sure. So that's that. So that had it takes us back to kind of what will enable each in terms of, the one argument is that AI will enable world government, encryption, blockchain will enable people's government. I think we can agree that the future will likely be more extreme, not more moderate. So there is like almost an assumption in political discourse for a while, for a long time, probably for decades, that kind of the world is converging, and the convergence is around like a liberal democratic nation state of some sort. And I think this is unraveling over the last 5, 10 years in different ways. And I think what we might be seeing is some parts of the world becoming more like world governments in terms of regional alliances, broader control in the government, and at the same time, more city states, more experiments in local government, more people coming together and setting up sub-sovereign or sub-national sovereign entities based on identities that are not national. And it will kind of happen at the same time. And that's why I present it as a fork, not as a prediction. Which force will win is it's always up to us, the people playing in the arena and kind of fighting the fight to decide. But I think both can coexist for a while.
I mean, one question I have is, it's perfectly possible to set up a sovereign entity, including an ever smaller ones, but it's no guarantee that a smaller entity will be more sovereign rather than less sovereign. So, there's been a lot of arguments, as you mentioned, over Scottish independence. And of course, one of the first things Scotland would do were to become independent is join the EU, which would be a supranational organization that would limit many areas of policy. And even aside from policy, I'm also struck by the degree to which, it's very hard for, there are very few countries in the world that seem capable of resisting a kind of cultural and economic globalization. There's a sense of which, once you've got the internet, once you've got access to this flood of wealth and information, that's all being like textured and manipulated by, very large corporations. It's very hard to sort of say, well, no, we're not going to do that. I mean, can you think of examples where people have been able to resist that, or are you more pessimistic?
I think we're seeing examples for the ability to resist it all the time because big chunks of the world don't have an actual sovereign. I give like two examples, like suburbs of Paris and suburbs of SF, but it's true for big parts of south of Italy. It's true for big parts of Latin America. It's true for a bunch of cities in the US that the sense of law and order, the sense of your ability, the ability of the state to actually monitor and enforce the law is a lot more limited than we tend to think. It's true for big parts in the Middle East. It's true for big parts of Africa. It's true for parts of Eurasia, right? And so we tend to overestimate because we have this model and we have the world map and we have the UN and we have the flag and the national government. We tend to overestimate how much the state is actually enforcing the law, right? And to underestimate how much different types of groups actually decide what's going on in a specific region. So I definitely see a path in which this is happening and kind of thousand flowers blooming in different places. But I do think it's important to make a distinction that it doesn't mean that the nation state will disappear. This can be a very gradual process, like the two historical analogies. It's like the kingdom versus the democracy in the UK. So we still have a king. It took like a very long process for the country to be fully democratic or however you want to define it. But it took a few hundred years from the Glorious Revolution onwards, et cetera. And another analogy is with the church. You still have the Catholic Church. And it used to essentially run parts of northern Italy and southern Europe, right? And it's still there. Effectively, if you do kind of a legal analysis, some laws are still governed by the church, etc. But it was hollowed out, essentially. So another way to kind of think of the process we're seeing with the nation state is that it's being hollowed out by the forces of new identities and new technologies.
So, where do you see this process happening? So, just to sort of localize this, because we're talking about big abstract terms. What do you see in Britain at the moment, for example, that kind of which sort of speaks to that kind of disintegration? Because I mean, from one perspective, the state looks stronger than ever. We had rioting, Keir Starmer. Within 5 minutes, people are being locked up, surveilled. New laws are on the books. It certainly looks like the state can very quickly enforce what it wants when it wants to.
Yeah, but then you can go to Paris and 5 minutes from the main street, there are neighborhoods in which the police doesn't go in.
No, and I am struck by in Birmingham, there was this, this BBC reporter turned up and got kind of chased out by groups of Muslims who turned out to sort of in reaction to the riots. And it was like very much the message was, this is our space, we control it, we're policing it. So you are seeing that, but of course it's striking that that is to a degree the outcome of political choice, that governments are kind of choosing not to police them. Though, I mean, why do you think governments are making choices like that?
Yeah, so I'm not trying to minimize the power of the state. I do think there's like a long history of, being skeptical of the king and the state, especially like in the kind of conservative thought in the last 60, 70, 80 years after the fascism and communism of the 30s, 40s, 50s. And I think that's kind of natural and to some extent healthy. But maybe this line of thought also brings us to overestimate the power. Because when you look at kind of entire regions and neighborhoods and lives, how much the state actually regulates action there, especially given new technologies that are being utilized, is up for grabs. And again, it's different across different regions, and the strength of the state or the coalition of state with technology and with states with technology platforms is a threat. That's why I think world government is also a choice, if you will, right? Because it kind of lends to greater efficiency, greater power begets kind of greater power and stuff like that. So I'm not minimizing the threat that there is. I think it's a big issue for our time. Paradoxically, or maybe not, it will also accelerate the fragmentation because people will understand the threat and they will say, you know, I want my gun, keep out of my territory, right? Or I want my piece of land somewhere in the Pacific or the Atlantic or whatever to find this island and to be with like-minded people and avoid the madness and kind of sordid realities of national politics.
So, I mean, if one is sort of, you know, a political actor, citizen, a politician, a policymaker, what sort of what one what how should this kind of framing inform your decision making? What ought you to think more about? What ought you to emphasize more?
So I think the main well, the cynical answer is one shouldn't be a politician, but and you should focus on kind of building new things and trying new things out in the world. But I think if there is like a practical message around like this kind of different visions for the future is that we need a lot more innovation in politics and fundamental innovation. So you look at the structure of in institutions. Let's talk about democracies for a second, in terms of the parliament structure, judicial structure, executive branch, bureaucracy structure, central banks, all of those entities, you know, were very capable once when the world was kind of structured differently. The election cycles, why is it every 4 years, not every 4 days, or every 40 years, or every 10? So there's a lot of like logic that was set up 200 years ago, and we didn't question enough for a long time. And usually it's for good reasons. It kind of worked. We want to keep it working. But then if we feel like the system is breaking, which I think a lot of people are, I would like to see a lot more experiments and innovation, not just in products, but also in government.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, I'm interested in what you think is driving this change. So, you know, in 1492, you know, in 1900, there were, you know, 53 political entities. You know, now at the end of the century, there are about 100, over 193 or so. You know, and in 1492, there were thousands. So we're clearly seeing, you know, a move. You know, clearly for centuries we were seeing fewer and fewer and fewer political entities over time, and it does seem like something has flipped. But why is it flipped? Is that, you know, is that ideological? Is it about democracy, as in, you know, human rights and nationalism, or is there something else going on?
I mean, my bias, given what I do in life, it's that it's primarily around technology, and the way you structure your realm of influence and ideology through closed networks, algorithm controlled, instant feedback. So the fact that you can build this technology from anywhere and you have the infrastructure to do it. So that's definitely, and that's a very new thing, right? The iPhone is from less than 15 years ago. But that had a major impact on how people, on ideology, on identity, on self-perception, on the rhythm of doing things in the world, et cetera. So I think it's a big impetus for people not understanding those institutions that are brilliant and have worked for a long time, but it really feels like they're not working anymore. Right. And I'm not saying like to take them down. And I think there is a gradual process of allowing ourselves to think a lot more first principles around sovereignty, government, and politics in a way that corresponds to people's daily life in a more accurate sense.
No, so I'm really interested in the sense of it being technologically driven. So obviously, you know, you mentioned encryption. As you all know, you know, the Telegram founder Pavel Durov was arrested in France recently, precisely over the issue of this, allegedly unregulated, highly encrypted communication network. Telegram has 900 million members. What did you make of that?
Yeah, so I mean that's a we can make this a case study, right? It's like on the one hand you have the governments, they want to control everything. They're actually collaborating between themselves, right? And they're arresting the guy that has an online platform. And the primary thing the online platform allows you to do is to get information that nobody controls and to talk with like-minded people. And those people are not only people from your nation, right? It's people that have similar hobbies, areas of interest, religious affiliations, ideological affiliations, and you can talk with them in an unencrypted way. You can transact with them in encrypted way, etc. So that's like a great case study why I think we're at a fork, and what I don't know which way the world will kind of go from here. It's like this is you can think of this as the tension or the battle of our time, and
No,
this is another case study, and we can think of a lot more, from tax evasion to immigration to trade to online censorship, etc.
and I'm really struck by this because once upon a time, in order to encrypt something, you needed, an army of cryptographers and continue, now every person in the world can download encryption software onto their phone. I mean, every phone is encrypted, in fact. And I'm struck sort of by this. It's very compelling, this idea of this kind of wrestling of control of this technology. So, you think about somewhere like, so I think of somewhere like, Romania under the, so under in the Eastern Bloc, 22 million people. In order to monitor that population, you needed 500,000 informants.
Yeah, the strategy,
Extraordinary.
yep.
And so there was a basic kind of challenge of, yes, the state could surveil everyone, but it required huge manpower resources to do so. And then you were stuck with the problem of, well, how do you sift through all this information? But now we're in a situation where, on the one hand, there's greatly more technological potential to frustrate the state's ability to surveil you, but there's also vastly more technology which can make that infinitely more efficient. So you think about, people talking about, combining AI with facial recognition. You can have a situation where the moment somebody turns up, an AI sends a police officer.
Yeah, so there's like in AI you have like the positive future in which governments just become a lot more effective, productive, and serve their citizens better because AI increases productivity, and you have all this great economic growth, and you have much more efficient government, and it has more of a negative future in which it's being used for social control, mind control, and you feel like you actually don't know the truth and what's going on around you, and you're like in this constant cycle of algorithms controlling what you see and understand about the world.
I mean, what do you think on the resolution of this kind of struggle to control technology will be? I mean, do you think, because at the moment we've got these very strong states, and then you've got these sort of tech billionaires, often with very kind of libertarian views about the role of the individual. I mean, do you think there is some kind of, I mean, do you think we just need to pick a side, or do you think there's some sense in which, political life, more local and democratic control can make sense of these kind of vast forces?
I think in the kind of medium term, what we'll see is both of those happening in an accelerated way. So some countries applying AI to become a lot more autocratic, and a bunch of regions becoming a lot more dysfunctional, and therefore you will see a lot more kind of people's autonomies of different sorts and different identities and affiliations.
So, I mean, your article, you reference, dystopian literature, and I think you said some of the sense of this world government stuff. It's often the subject of, conspiracy theory, fiction. I think for a lot of people, it has that kind of quality. So, what do you think, this sort of, I don't want to say catastrophizing because it sounds sort of negative, but this sort of sense of this pessimism about the future is so compelling, and it's so kind of fascinating. Like, I enjoy reading about it, I enjoy writing about it. What do you think it is that attracts us I mean, on this almost perverse way to these kind of very sort of strong visions of dark futures.
So, I'm in a business in which you want to envision a positive future and you work hard to make it happen. So, I mean, there's definitely a bias to see the negative because that's how you survive. And especially when it's something you don't understand, you kind of take some precautionary approach. And I think part of seeing the negative in technology is kind of its current cultural bias. I do think some technologies free us and some technologies can enslave us, but those are political decisions to make. And because they're political, they're up to people, human beings to decide.
It's been really fascinating, Gal. I'm just going to polish off with one question, which is, we're here in the UK. What direction do you see for, for Britain? Which direction do you currently think the UK is heading in? Are we headed for people's governments or for world governments?
I think you're one of the most fascinating places to watch closely because that's essentially what's playing out with the demonstrations and riots over the last couple of weeks. You obviously invented democracy and no taxation without representation.
Don't tell the French.
You might also be kind of the battleground for this to play out. It's hard for me to say, given I haven't lived in the UK for a while, for almost a decade now, and it's hard to make predictions. I do think there's instinctual being an island state, and being like proud people. I think there's something instinctually sovereign about the British people. So I think they will maintain their freedom in different sorts, and it might play out a bit more in a people's government framework.
Well, on that optimistic note of Britain headed for people's government, I'm going to thank Gal so much for that fascinating interview. Gal, thank you.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.